Connor stood absolutely still, stunned by what he was seeing. Kids, adults, a lot of people, were looking not at the fire but at him. They were stealthy, but they were very definitely surrounding him. He could hear a sort of grumbling whisper, as if they had lost all humanity and turned into snarling animals that had only one enemy on this earth. This was not making sense. It had seemed sort of understandable at school, but not here. Nobody should care. They were here to see the fire of the century, not to go after some kid. Turning slowly round and round, he watched them. Any moment, one or another of them was going to jump him. Kill, he heard, once or twice. But most of the thought was more primitive than words. It was an incoherent snarling. And every time he moved, it rose, got more sinister. And they came closer. As Charles Gunn reached the flight deck of TRA-4, the control surfaces flickered to life. Immediately he turned on the plasma engine and watched the batteries charge. Because it was daylight, he'd need to use camouflage the whole way. He was going to Wilton himself. He wanted to be low and close. There just wasn't any other way. Also, there was a possibility that he might be able to reach Mike using the ship's super-secure sideband system that was capable of keeping TRs around the world in touch with each other and was not accessible to outside tracking. Henry was working on the scalar weapon orders. He'd probably be able to start pulsing in about an hour, unless, of course, the president, who was by no means stupid, had taken steps to close the many back doors into the Pentagon's operations system. Charge, the plane said in its soft female voice.
Deploy shield.
Done. He hit the button on his throat intercom.
How do I look?
You're ready to proceed, sir.
Open the doors.
As he watched the monitor, the huge hangar doors opened. He would move out, then go straight up to minimize the number of people who would observe a very strange phenomenon, a gigantic triangular shadow, apparently cast by nothing. A close look would reveal the ship, but protocol required daylight takeoff to use full plasma and all fans to ascend to 1,400 feet immediately. At this altitude, the shadow would be too diffuse to be seen except from the air, and the air above Andrews was, because of this operation, at present entirely clear of aircraft. Sir, came a voice in his earphone. Return to the hangar, please, sir. It was base ATC. What in the world were they doing interfering?
Excuse me?
We have new orders, sir. TRs are grounded effective immediately. The president had closed the operation down. Charles acted with characteristic speed and decision. He immediately took the TR up. Inside of 30 seconds, it was completely undetectable. Not by radar, not visually, not in any way at all. Incredibly, his cell phone rang. For a moment he was furious. Voices inside the TR were damped, but if Andrews had deployed its sonic scanners, they might pick up that ring. He fought it out of his pocket and opened it.
Charles, I'm being arrested, Verona's voice said. He's pulling us in, all of us.
Charles thought fast. Then he saw instantly just how to contain this.
Henry, stay calm. Do you have the scaler's codes?
Yeah, but they're busting in my door right now.
Give me the codes.
This isn't a safe line. This is do it. Code of the day is B Bravo, C Charlie, Z Zero, G Gremlin, N. Then 1-9er, 1 in 6338 nanosecond time sequence.
The line disconnected. Okay, his next act was to activate sideband. He had the TR moving away from Andrews at its top speed of 320 miles per hour.
Mike?
He waited. Nothing. He punched up the signal-seeking equipment.
This is TRA-4 for TRA-1. Mike?
There was a carrier out there, but Mike wasn't answering. Maybe he wasn't aboard the TR. Charles decided that he had to trust Mike to do his job. His first priority now was to save the trust. A TR was richly endowed with communications. In fact, an entire subset of controls for the scalar weapons would turn on as soon as it was fully deployed. This way, a TR could stand in close and watch the effective scalar pulses that it was triggering and make fine adjustments in their strength and angle, while remaining entirely unaffected by the earthquakes they were causing on the ground just a few feet below. Charles went into the plane's operational manual and read as he flew, pressing buttons on a console. Far overhead, rocket servos on the scalar weapon began once more to fire as his commands redeployed it. He had no idea that the Greys had sabotaged its previous deployment, but this didn't matter, because it would seek to its new coordinates from wherever it happened to be. As he worked, its long black snout swept back across the blue of the ocean, back to the land. It stopped, then, and with tiny bursts of the servos, began to move about, as if it was hunting for something. When a city appeared below it, the motion stopped. On the TR, Charles watched a screen. He pressed buttons, and the image became clearer. He zoomed again, and the image was clearer still. He had pointed the scalar weapon directly at Washington, D.C. He turned the plane on its axis and headed directly into the D.C. no-fly zone. 31. Inside the grain elevator, three figures, all dressed in silver protective gear with full hoods and gloves, moved carefully across the broad floor. Nobody on the outside was aware of the presence of Colonel Robert Langford and this specialized crew. Dr. Simpson had phoned him while they were driving into town. "If he's dead, you will need to collect tissue, Colonel Langford. I want cell-rich tissue. Do it the way the Greys do. Take the eyes, the lips, the genitals. We are going to need to build a clone of him." He'd wanted to ask why, but he knew that he had no need to know and therefore didn't waste his breath. So what he had said was what duty demanded. "Yes, sir." "We're looking at imminent structural failure, sir," a voice crackled in Langford's ears.
"I know it."
He lifted an electronic bullhorn to his lips.
"Lewis? Lewis crew?"
His loss, in Rob's opinion, would be greater than the loss of the Gray that had departed the Indianapolis facility. Adam was so deceptive and complicated, there was no telling what anything they got from him really meant. But Lewis was as straight as they came, and he knew many secrets. Maybe his story about coming from another world was even true. A rumble from above drew his attention. Like a gigantic missile, a flaming beam arched down and hit the floor in a shower of sparks.
"Careful, guys," Rob said. "We can't afford any attrition here." "I've got an organic mass."
Captain Forbes raised his viewer away from his face mask.
"Oxygen level warning," Airman Winkler announced, meaning that he had 5 minutes before compulsory withdrawal.
Langford moved through a forest of fallen, burning beams to reach Forbes. At his feet was a corpse.
"Okay, let's collect tissue and pull out."
It was so badly burned that it looked more like a black log than a body.
"Holy moly, Colonel." "Take it easy, gentlemen. Let's bag this."
It affected him deeply to see Lewis this burned. The poor guy was almost unrecognizable, but not completely. What a way to go. What a rotten death for that good man. High above, a roar started.
"Move it, now."
Paulie and Connor stood side by side. Connor stayed close to the Warners because they were not having these weird thoughts, not like the others, and they didn't have shadows around them. They were shimmering with what he had come to see as normal colors of life. The others came closer. He looked for his mom and dad, didn't see them. The haze from the spray and the smoke was like a fog bank full of looming shadows, the roar of the fire and the rumble of hoses, and strange, echoing cries. He dared not move, dared not call out. In his heart, though, he begged for his mom and dad, begged them to get him out of here. Paulie and his family had no idea that anything was wrong. He innocently pointed his video camera at the burning elevator. Amy took pictures with her cell phone. The whole wall of the building was now smoking. It shuddered and made a sighing sound.
"He's calling us," Dan said. "I hear him clearly."
"You can hear him? How can you hear him?"
"Caitlin, I told you it's the implant, and I'm sure that he's in terrible trouble."
"I can't hear him. Why can't I hear my child?"
"You don't have an implant."
"But that's...
we'll sort it out later."
He moved off, trying to see ahead through the smoke and haze and gathering dark.
"Connor? Connor?"
Connor decided that, no matter how it looked, half the town could not be coming after him. They didn't even know him, most of them. So this was paranoia. He would not allow himself to react to a symptom as if it was real. He wasn't that paranoid. Yet. Nearby, two people leaped into their cars and began driving this way. Harley ushered the kids away.
"They're pulling out too fast in this ice," he said.
Then one of them skidded into the other, and they both went spinning around, slamming into each other, and bouncing off amid a flying shower of glass.
"Did you see those cars?" Dan yelled to Caitlin. "Connor! Connor!"
They moved through the nightmare murk, both calling his name again and again. As she walked beside him, struggling with him in this bizarre nightmare situation, she thought, if he has to, he will give his life for his family. As if the sudden, deep love this realization made her feel had opened a door, she remembered being in a dark space, remembered it quite clearly. At her feet there was a round opening. Far below, she could see water in the moonlight. A boy was beside her, his dark hair scattered across his forehead. His eyes were scared, but he was so attractive that a shiver went through her when she saw him. She remembered reaching out to him, and in that instant, knew it was Dan, when they were children. She felt then the most exquisite, most deeply poignant sense of memory that she had ever known. Without being able to put it into words, but just feeling it, she saw the role she and Dan had to play in what she perceived as a plan of some sort that she could not even begin to understand, but that involved Connor.
"Dan, we have to find him."
"I know it."
Then he pointed.
"Caitlin, there."
He was not 30 feet away, just visible through the swirling ice haze, and Kenneth Brearley, a Bell 10th grader, was standing in front of him, pointing a pistol at him. Connor disappeared behind a billowing mass of haze from one of the hoses.
"Connor!" Caitlin bellowed. "Connor, run!"
Despite the danger of being seen by Wilkes or somebody under his orders, Lauren left the office and moved closer to the base perimeter. She had no car and dared not draw from the motor pool. She had to get to Connor, she knew that, but how? It was miles to the town, there was no bus. She'd tried to call the cab company, but there hadn't been any answer. Everybody was at the fire, no doubt. That fire was bait, she was certain, set by Wilkes to draw the whole town. Connor was a 12-year-old boy. He would be there. Mike would kill him and make it look like an accident. She pulled out her cell phone and called Rob again. It was a futile gesture. She tried to somehow reach out to Connor, attempting to communicate with him via her mind. Maybe he heard her and maybe he didn't, but she certainly felt no response. She looked down the long road that led to the town, to the gigantic smoke cloud, magnificent in the fading sun. For the first time in so long, their memory of it was nothing but a few dim sparks. The three thieves felt love. They felt it fiercely, hanging over the burning building, for the child down there in the mist, who glowed gold in the dull, swirling crowd of other souls. They saw also the antenna and the signals flaring off it, impacting the red flaring implants in the heads of people in the crowd. The antenna was connected to a transmitter, it must be, but the live voltage would be too low to make the wire visible to them. They hung far above, their small oval ship out of sight above the smoke, watching Connor. And they saw, suddenly, somebody with a gun. "Help me," they heard Connor's mind saying. They felt something strange within them, the beating of the heart, and they understood at last why Connor was calling for help, what all these strange signals meant. Wilkes had used a primitive form of mind control to turn dozens of people into assassins. Kenneth was an honor student, an Eagle Scout, and a very proud young citizen, and he was absolutely terrified at what he was doing. He remembered some kind of a nightmare with this strange whispering man in his room, and he had woken up crazy like this, and he knew it was crazy. But he could not stop himself. He'd been turned into a killing machine, and the worst of it was that he just needed to kill this geeky middle schooler and do it now. He kept losing him in the haze, but just for a second or two, so he was getting closer fast. Then he found a clear shot. He raised the pistol. He aimed. And, Jesus, what the hell was that? Oh, no, he hadn't disappeared. He was still there. He was 4 feet away. He could not miss. He pressed the trigger, which did not go back. He stopped, cursed himself, thumbed the safety off, and raised the pistol again. Connor looked into his eyes, down the barrel of the gun, and felt his body begin making tiny movements, very quick, tiny movements, that seemed somehow linked to the kid's vision. Kenneth started to pull the trigger, and this time Connor cleanly and clearly disappeared right before his eyes. There was no obscuring haze. He was just gone. Then he saw him again, flickering back into existence as he shook his own head, as if that had been enough to make him visible again. Now he would not miss. Dan tackled him from behind, and he went down without a sound. The pistol flew off into the murk, and the next thing Kenneth knew, the world was dark. "Dan, don't kill him. He's just knocked out. Where's that pistol?" "Oh, God, Dan, look." Linda Fells did not know why she had brought her dad's deer gutter. She loathed the ugly hooked knife, hated it when he brought home does to carve up. But now she had to use it, and she knew on who, and even though she was screaming in revulsion and fear, she marched toward Connor Callahan, raising it as she went. She screamed and shook her head, trying to get rid of these thoughts, but the thoughts only got stronger and stronger. Dan ran toward her with all his might, but he tripped on a hose and went sliding in the ice, screaming for Connor to watch out that she was behind him. Caitlin howled, "Connor! Connor!" and struggled as if through mud, crossing the slick of ice, hoses, and fallen people that lay between them and their boy. The three thieves moved down toward the roof of the grain elevator. They had to reach that antenna and the transmitter connected to it, but the collective was horrified to see that they could not reach it unless they descended into flames and certain death. But they couldn't die, they mustn't. No other triad was prepared to replace them. This had not been anticipated. The one said, "We have to save him." The two said, "We have to save ourselves." The three leaped out of the craft and dropped down through the air. As he fell, a great mass of fire enveloped him, and the whole collective howled his pain and his loss. He saw fire all around him, a red haze. He felt his bones growing hot, felt essential processing systems in his body begin to boil. He reached the lip of the great tank. The whole structure was unstable. He could feel it shaking, could see the flames licking at it. It would not last long, but even another moment was too much time. He ripped off the antenna, pulling it away from the concrete lip of the huge tank to which it had been affixed. As he looked for the transmitter, a great tongue of fire enveloped him. His skin began to pop and shatter, his limbs to shake, then to gyrate wildly as millions of micromotors lost control of themselves. He broadcast alarm, alarm, as he felt himself ceasing to function. He dropped the antenna, which went sailing off into the flames. His left eye exploded in a shower of sparks. He fell farther. The one went after him, dropping also into the flames, attempting to save him, struggling against the fire, and he too caught fire. His head exploded in a flashing mass of sparks. The antenna was gone, but not the transmitter. It remained taped to the lip of the tank, its red diode gleaming, still sending its signal, although weakened, to every one of Wilkes's killers. The two took the craft up fast, faster than a bullet, all the way to the edge of space. Connor felt them leaving him. "Don't go," his mind cried. "Don't cut me off." But he was cut off. There was now no sense of the presence of the collective within him. He felt it as a silence at the center of his being. "Come back to me," he screamed. But the thieves could not hear him. Not the dead. Not the frightened, confused survivor far away. Dan and Caitlin reached Connor at last. "Mom, Dad, something's wrong. We have to go." "Oh, Connor, dear God, Connor, I couldn't find you," Dan said. Caitlin threw her arms around him. "Let's go home now," she said. "Right now." "Hi, Mrs. Callahan." Caitlin backed away from the girl. She knew what was in her hand. She had seen it. "Stay right there," she told her. "Don't you come near him." The girl stepped closer. She was a pretty girl with a sweet, open smile. There's nothing wrong, Mrs. Callahan.
Then what do you want?
Nothing.
Why are you carrying that knife?
The girl raised it and leaped straight past Caitlin. Connor stepped to one side and she slashed down where he had been standing. Snarling, she raised it again, looking around as if she couldn't see him. Caitlin grabbed her arm, then Dan leaped on her from behind and got the knife out of her hand.
Who are you? What the hell's the matter with you?
The girl crumpled, bursting into tears. Here and there other people, freed by the weakening signal, began screaming, holding their heads, throwing down weapons. On the roof of the grain elevator, the metal skeletons of the two greys smoked and sparked in the licking flames. They moved, though, flickering and twitching, as if they wanted to stand. High above, the two concentrated, his head down, his hands over his face. One skeleton actually rose a few inches, stretched an arm toward the transmitter, trembled, and fell back. The bones fell into the maelstrom. Now the other moved a little, its hand scraping along the lip of the tank, then touching the edge of the transmitter, the black claws scrabbling at its power switch, then falling to a jumble of gleaming metal bones and black claws. The tiny red diode on the transmitter remained lit. At that moment, the grain elevator collapsed, leaving only the three enormous tanks standing. The light on the transmitter flickered, went out, but then came on again, glowing steadily. Huge pieces of concrete began falling off the tank. Inside, Rob and his team threw themselves into the cellar where the elevator's motors were housed. A massive tongue of fire roared at them from above, coming through the hatchway like a living, questing monster, grasping for their lives. The space was long, the far end collapsed and burning. The floor above them groaned, ready to buckle. He thought he had perhaps 20 seconds to get these men out of here. The Callahans began moving away from the debris, Caitlin and Dan shielding their son as best they could. As they headed for their car, Jimbo Kelton came over to them. He was smiling.
"Hey, Jimbo," Dan said. "Watch our backs. We..."
Jimbo lifted his arms over his head and brought a rock down on Connor. Connor ducked, but not fast enough to avoid getting hit in the shoulder. A stab of pain went through him, and he cried out. Jimbo raised the rock again. Then another rock hit Connor in the neck and bounced off. It had been thrown by Mrs. Kelton, and she and Jimbo were both gathering more projectiles, fragments of lumber, of tin, anything to throw at him. Their faces were gray, their eyes watery and crazy. As a third rock hit Connor, he ran toward the car. Now Terry Kelton tackled him and tried to drag him down, but he pushed him off. Catching up with him, Caitlin grabbed his jacket and dragged him toward the car as Dan fought off the Keltons, screaming and kicking, backing toward the car.
"Dan, John has a rifle," Caitlin shouted as she and Connor reached the car.
"Run!" Connor jumped into the back of the car and crouched down on the floor. His head and his back throbbed where he'd been hit. Caitlin and Dan got in and slammed the front doors. As they pulled out, a rock hit the back window, transforming it into a haze of cracks.
"What in damn hell is the matter?" Dan yelled.
"Look, please, I'm sorry. I know I did something, and I'm so sorry."
"You didn't do a damn thing, son."
As they drove away, Connor came up from the floor. He sat hunched against the door, staring out the window at the bizarre scene, which faded quickly into the gathering winter evening. They went toward Oak Road, turning up Wilton, taking the lonely way.
"This is a mistake," Connor said.
"What do you mean?" Dan asked.
"The lonely way."
32. Lauren was almost insane with worry and fear when at last a two-car convoy appeared at the main gate. Rob's car was in front, a Cherokee behind, full of specialists and fire control gear. As he pulled up, he opened his window.
"We're not out of the woods, and I need you right now."
She ran around and got in the car. The Cherokee headed off into the base.
"Why in hell didn't you call me? My God, I almost lost my mind."
"You had orders, Colonel."
"Orders? Dear God, the military mind is... Oh, forget it. What's our situation?"
"Crew is dead, and Wilkes is at large. He may have made an escape in a stolen TR.
"What's a TR?
Classified vehicle, he replied tightly.
He killed Lewis Crewe?
Details later. We've got a hell of a situation back there. I don't know exactly what else he's done, but we've got to get that kid to safety, or we're going to have another dead body on our hands right away. At that moment, the bass siren sounded, and the guards began closing the gates. Rob turned the car around and headed back toward town.
What in the world is going on?
It seems that Wilton is rioting.
You're kidding.
They're killing each other.
She closed her eyes, playing move after move, and came to a conclusion.
Wilkes couldn't identify exactly which child, so he did something that would turn the whole place violent, in hopes that all the children would be killed.
One possibility. Another is that he did identify him but was scared to take direct action because of the Greys, and is using this as a diversion.
But the family, they're miles out of town.
They came to the fire. I know that. I identified the car. They are not there at this time, however.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, we're in trouble.
And you're certain about Mr. Crewe?
He's in a bag on his way to Wright, Pat.
Was he really from another world? Is that true?
He glanced at her. You might as well accept that there is no final truth in this thing, not ever. This reality, more than any other, changes depending on the way you look at it. As far as I know, the man could be from Chicago or Denver or anywhere, but he was a good man and a useful man, which is the bottom line on Lewis Damn Crewe.
Rob stopped the car. They'd come around the curve in the highway which opened onto Main Street.
Smoke rose from at least four different fires. A man shot a rifle from the roof of a store. Groups of people ran through the streets, most of them armed with hunting rifles. Sirens howled, and as they watched, a garbage truck backed at full speed into the front of the First Church of Christ. Its steeple, bells pealing, tumbled over the truck and into the street.
Rob flipped open his cell phone, speed-dialed a number. The situation in the town is deteriorating fast. You'd better get the governor on the horn, General, because the place is gone. He needs the National Guard out here. The state cops won't be enough.
A Buick packed with kids snarled toward them, its tires leaving smoke in the street. Rob turned the wheel full right and jammed the gas pedal to the floor. A second later, the Buick passed behind them and raged on, swerving to snap fire plugs. Screaming laughter could be heard, full of terror. Rob pulled over to the side of the road.
We can't drive through that.
No.
We're going to have to cross the town by helicopter, locate the child on the other side, and I think we need to just move him, get him out of here.
What about Mike? What about the group? Won't they keep trying?
Rob looked at her for a long moment.
I never said this would be easy.
Dan drove hard, trying to get back to Oak Road before the craziness spread there, if it was going to. He would defend his family with his pistol until they could leave this place. For the Callahans, Wilton and Bell College were history, and to hell with his precious tenure. Bell would probably fall apart now anyway. Who would send their children to a place like this?
Connor, Caitlin said, do you have any idea what's happened to these people?
Dan thought it was a fair question to ask this child who had changed so much. You could see it in his face, a new steadiness in his eyes.
It has to do with me.
At that moment there was a snap and the car shook.
What was that?
Connor knew that it was a bullet. He'd felt the hate of the person who'd fired the gun. He pressed himself down below the level of the windows.
Connor.
It hit the left fender just above the tire.
What did?
Mom asked.
A bullet.
Dan increased their speed.
Connor,
Caitlin screamed.
Why?
That wasn't the right question, he knew. They needed a different energy to survive this. Fear would not save them. He needed the three thieves. Now that they were gone, he saw how they'd been his link to the collective, and how important the collective would be to him in the future. He also saw how they helped him now, watching over him, doing the small essential things that had saved him, giving their lives for him. There was a bang in the front, and the car swerved over to the side of the road. Dan tried to keep it going, but it slurried all over the place.
That's a shot-out tire, Connor said.
I know it, Dan snapped. Mom turned around, and he had never seen her look like that. Her eyes were like shattered glass. Mom and Dad were panicked. He had to get away from them. He could not let the bad decisions they were going to make kill him.
"Stop the car, Dad."
"I can't do that. My God, we're being fired on."
Connor breathed hard, bit his lips to keep the sobs in, then opened the door and threw himself out into a snowbank. He rolled like you're supposed to, and proceeded to hit Mr. Niederdorfer's fence so hard he saw stars. He heard the car growling, and, as he got up, he saw it skidding around in the snowy road, its right front tire now also in shreds. A whisper flashed past his face, followed by an echoing crack. Far down the road, he could see a car with somebody standing on it. That person had a rifle, and he was lifting it to aim again. He needed to get to the trees on the Niederdorfer land. He hopped the fence and trudged off in snow up to his waist. Mom burst out of the car.
"No, come back, Connor, no!"
She leaped the fence, surged ahead like some kind of raging lioness. Then Dan came plunging through the snow behind her. He closed the distance even faster than she did.
"You've got to get back in the car."
"In the car, Connor, it's our only hope."
"Trust me," he said, reaching for her hand. He looked to his father.
"Trust me, Dad."
Then he heard somebody else coming fast, their breath whistling. A glance over his shoulder revealed Jimbo Kelton surging through the snow with superhuman power. In his right hand was a big axe. Connor ran. He could only hope his parents would do the same. There were thousands of acres of forest out here that would significantly improve the odds. Staying with a disabled car was obviously not the best move. Then the trees were around Connor, and he could dart and twist and turn and get through them fast. But Jimbo was bigger and faster, and Connor knew that it would not be long before he caught up. He got to a clear space and ran for all he was worth, then veered off, trying as much as possible to avoid dislodging snow from the branches of the pines all around him, and stepping in places where the snow on the ground was lightest. Lauren sat behind Rob and the pilot as the chopper moved quickly over the mad town. There was a sharp snap, then a ping, then another.
"Incoming," the pilot said.
"Bastards," Rob muttered.
A vibration started.
"Sir, I took rotor damage off that rifle fire," the pilot said into the intercom. "Keep it in the air." "Sir, I need to return to base immediately. Keep it in the air." "I'll go down, sir." "Even if you end up crashing this thing, you have to get me where I'm going." "This is my bird, sir, and I've got to return to base. Captain, our lives are not as important as this mission. None of us."
"Sir, this is the single most important thing this Air Force has ever done. We cannot, I repeat, cannot fail. We must put at least one effective on the ground in the right place, and nothing else matters. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir. Losing altitude, sir."
"Down there," Lauren shouted over the roar of the chopper. He saw it. An elderly blue car smashed into a fence by the roadside, and the trenches of runners leading off towards the woods. Three trenches. The one in the middle smaller. From another direction there came a fourth trench.
"I don't like the look of that," Rob said.
"The family's being stalked."
"Exactly. One, no, four. Four other tracks."
He pointed, and Lauren saw them too. Four distinct lines in the snow, all coming from the direction of a station wagon parked about a quarter of a mile behind the Callahan's vehicle.
"Sir, I am losing control of this bird."